Stay tuned for Making Contact at 11 with Beyond Stonewall. Is there a little more I can tell you about that? No, you'll just have to keep it locked right here at your community radio. That's right, your community radio, which means the responsibility for maintaining and running it is your responsibility. However you get involved, once you get involved in a way that it makes sense for you to become a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can see about making yourself a member of the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors and take a more concrete role in guiding the station to represent and promote the interests of the community in having an electronic media outlet that is here to serve the community. Think about that. And think about how and why KBOO was able to bring you a program like this.
When you think of Pride, parades and parties might come to mind. It might be hard to imagine that the worldwide LGBT celebrations were sparked by a neighborhood uprising in New York in 1969. At the time, the uprising was heavily criticized. But by 2014, even the president was paying tribute to what began that night at the Stonewall Inn.
This year we mark the 45th anniversary of Stonewall, and I know some of you were there. And this tremendous progress we've made as a society is thanks to those of you who fought the good fight, and to Americans across the country who marched and came out and organized to secure the rights of others.
But how many of us really remember what happened back in 1969? On today's show, we'll hear about the day that galvanized a generation and the continued fight for LGBT civil rights. I'm Laura Flynn, and you're listening to Making Contact. The first Pride Parade took place in June 1970, marking the first anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. Michael Shirker brings us this oral history, remembering Stonewall, the birth of a movement.
In 1969, the Stonewall was one of the most popular gay bars in New York City, and, like all other gay bars, was routinely raided by the Vice Squad. The patrons of these bars, many of whom were frightened at having their identities revealed, would quietly submit to any orders coming from the police. Yet, on June 27th, 1969, that all changed. The patrons of this bar, with the drag queens at the forefront, decided to fight back against the police. What happened here on that night would spark a revolution.
I am Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
He also would like to know what your age is. So you
my
tell
age,
him your age.
78? Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you touched me, when you took my hand, something happened I had never planned.
Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as straight as possible. The general attitude of society as far as employers were concerned and landlords, all of these people were very hostile, and to protect ourselves, we had to act as rugged and manly as possible.
Name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police.
My name is Seymour Pine. In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the 1st Division in the police department, which covered South Manhattan from 38th Street to the Battery, including the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality.
My name is Reb Mahoney. I've been hanging out, drinking, partying, and working in the gay bars for the last 30 years. In the era before Stonewall, all of the bars, 90% of the bars, were mafia controlled. They were controlled because the mafia had the right connections. There wasn't that many gay bars. You'd have maybe one, two uptown in the Upper East Side. They would get closed down, and there'd be one or two in the West Side. They'd get closed down, and Midtown there'd be one, two, three maybe open. As they would get closed down, they'd move around, and they were dumps.
I'm Joan Nessel, co-founder of what is now the largest collection of lesbian culture in the world. The police raided lesbian bars regularly, and they both did it in the most obvious way, which was hauling women away in paddy wagons. But there was regular weekend harassment, which would consist of the police coming in regularly to get their payoffs. And in the Sea Colony, we had a back room with a red light, and when that red light went on, it meant the police would be arriving in around 10 minutes. And so we all had to sit down at our tables. And we would be sitting there almost like school children. And the cops would come in. Now, depending on who was on, which cop was on, if it was some that really resented the butch women, who were with many times very beautiful women, we knew we were in for it, because what would happen is they would start harassing one of these women and saying, "Huh, you think you're a man? Come outside, we'll show you." And the woman would be dragged away. They'd throw up against a wall, and they'd say, "So you think you're a man? Let's see what you got in your pants." And they would put their hand down her pants.
On Friday night, June 27, 1969, at about 11:45, eight officers from Public Morals 1st Division loaded into four unmarked police cars. From their headquarters on 21st Street and 3rd Avenue, they headed downtown and then west towards the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. It was the second time the bar was raided that week. The local 6th Precinct had just received a new commanding officer who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. And New York was in the midst of a mayoral campaign, always a bad time for homosexuals. Mayor John Lindsay had good reason to agree to the police crackdown. He had just lost his party's primary and needed a popularity boost. And the Stonewall Inn was indeed an inviting target. Operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license, this dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, minors, and more masculine lesbians known as bull dykes. Many were black or Hispanic. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Moral Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting. One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out, at which time we had to chase that person, and he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the other door, and at that point we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon, and there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor-style hair, and she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on her. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
My name is Howard Smith. On the night of the Stonewall riots, I was a reporter for the Village Voice, locked inside with the police, covering it for my column. it really did appear that that crowd, because we could look through little peepholes in the plywood windows, we could look out, and we could see that the crowd, well, my guess was within 5-10 minutes, it was probably several thousand people now, 2,000, easy. And they were yelling, kill the cops, police brutality, let's get them, we're not going to take this anymore, let's
we
get
them. We noticed a group of persons attempting to uproot one of the parking meters, in which they did succeed. And they then used that parking meter to as a battering ram to break down the door. And they did, in fact, open the door. They crashed it in. And at that point was when they began throwing Molotov cocktails into the place.
There were a couple of cops stationed on either side of the door with their pistols, like in a combat stance, aimed in the door area. A couple others were stationed in other places, behind like a pole, another one behind the bar. All of them with their guns ready. I don't think up to that point I had ever seen cops that scared.
When the Morrill Squad officers barricaded themselves inside the Stonewall, Deputy Inspector Pine put in a 1041 call, an emergency help request which can only be placed by a high-ranking officer. That call was mysteriously canceled, and the telephone inside the Stonewall went dead. It took nearly 45 minutes for the riot police to get to the Stonewall and rescue the Morrill Squad from the smoldering bar.
My name is Martin Boyce, and in 1969 I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms like the Rockettes and sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls, we wear our hair in curls, we wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Rudy, and the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street, and there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe.
My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian, and I guess you would label me as a butch. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen, blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks, gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there, whether we were scared or not, we didn't think about it, we just jumped in.
The media covered the riot extensively. The Daily News featured it on its front page. There were reports on all the local television and radio stations. By the next day, graffiti calling for gay power had appeared on buildings and sidewalks all over the West Village. Hastily worked up flyers, distributed on street corners, touted the night as the hairpin drop heard round the world. And the next night, thousands of men and women converged on the West Village. They came here, back to the Stonewall, to see what would happen next. While trash cans were set on fire, stones were thrown, and sporadic fighting broke out between police and gays, the more than 400 riot police milling around the village ensured that the previous night's violence would not be repeated. But on this night, for the first time, gay couples could be seen walking hand in hand or kissing in the streets. Just by being there, surrounded by reporters and photographers and onlookers, thousands of men and women were proclaiming to themselves and the rest of the world that they were gay. And the crowds grew and came back the next night, and for one more night the following week. What happened here on those nights helped to usher in a new era, both personally and politically, for gay men and lesbians.
My name is Jim Forat, and in the mid-60s, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, I was one of the founders of the Yippie movement. I remember on the third night of the riots, there was this meeting called by Mattachine Society at St. John's Church on West on Waverly Place. We went, and Randy Wicker was running the meeting.
For 10 years, I've been going on television as Randy Wicker, the respectable homosexual dressed in dark suit and tie, explaining to people that most homosexuals look like everybody else and behave like everybody else. And when Stonewall began happening, you had chorus lines of queens kicking their heels up at the police, bonfires burning in the corner trash baskets and throwing bricks and stones at the police. I was horrified because this violated everything that we thought of as responsible behavior, that this was not the way respectable citizens behaved.
Evelyn Hooker was a sociologist, I believe. Randy had introduced her, and she got up, and she suggested that we should have a candlelight march, that we should turn the other cheek because gay people were really different, we were really nice, and we had to show how nice we were and stop all this rioting because people were going to get hurt. I remember I stood up, and I said, no, we are not going back. And people felt the same thing I felt. And we marched out of that room, and that was the night that the Gay Liberation Front was born.
That night, in some very deep way, we finally found our place in history. Not as a dirty joke, not as a doctor's case study, not as a freak, but as a people. Imagine myself
away from you. Remembering Stonewall was engineered by Spider Blue. It was produced by David Isay with a grant from the Pacifica National Program Fund. I'm Michael Shirker.
That piece was made available to us courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. To hear the full-length version, visit pacificaradioarchives.org. What began with Stonewall still continues today. After the break, we'll hear from Michelangelo Signorelli on what it will take to get an LGBT civil rights bill.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to download shows or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
So you might remember the controversy around Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Critics argued the law would have allowed businesses to discriminate against same-sex couples, but supporters said it would protect individuals following the tenets of their faith. Following a massive backlash, including a threat from several businesses to leave the state, Governor Mike Pence approved a fix prohibiting businesses from refusing to serve people based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Editor-at-large of the Huffington Post, Gay Voices, Michelangelo Signorelli, says while the reversal in Indiana was among a series of recent wins for the LGBT rights movement, bigotry remains a daily reality. At a New America NYC forum, Signorelli spoke with June Thomas, culture critic and editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ section, about what he calls victory blindness. It's a central theme in his new book titled, It's Not Over, Getting to Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality.
One of the main ideas that you return to throughout the book is the concept of victory blindness. What do you mean by that?
Well, I really started to sort of see several years ago a kind of a disconnect between the celebrations of victory that we've had and the facts on the ground for so many people across the country. And a lot of this was what I was hearing on my show from people and connecting with people online. And I felt like the media, the establishment, a lot of LGBT activists, they weren't kind of getting how there was this disconnect. And I found it very troubling. And I really saw how people kind of focus on the wins, focus on the victories, and it almost becomes a sort of a psychological thing where you protect yourself by not focusing on the continued bigotry, by not looking at that, and that's where you sort of become blind to it. You don't see it. You're only focusing on the wins, everything getting better. It's going to get better. It's going to all be great, and not seeing how the backlash is organizing and how people are experiencing hardship all across the country. They're still deeply closeted. They're still dealing with bullying. If they're young people, they're still far too many taking their lives. So that's victory blindness. Mm-hmm.
Is it really so bad for us to focus on the good news in our community?
No, I think it's important to celebrate the good news. It's when we focus on the winds and don't see the gathering storm out there, don't see the organizing that's going on, or downplay it. People convince themselves we've won so much. That's the other thing, that we've won so much that it's at risk, that we better be careful and not rock the boat. So then we start to pull back on the approach, and we start to say, let's be magnanimous. This word magnanimous has crept up, and I talk about it in that first chapter with Mozilla and Brendan Eich, the CEO who stepped down, and too many of our people were saying, this looks bad that he stepped down because he was a homophobe. And I just found something problematic with that. And they said, well, we should be magnanimous in our wins. We've had a banner 2 years. This was another one. Well, banner 2 years, what is that? We need civil rights in this country. So I think there's a lot of that kind of talk.
You also say that, this is a quote now, gay people have always needed to be confrontational in order to make great strides forward. First, I'm wondering, do you still think that today? I mean, it's kind of easier to think about being confrontational 45, 30, 15, 10 years ago. Shouldn't we be, no, I'm not gonna say shouldn't we be magnanimous, but it's, first of all, it's hard to get people to be confrontational. There's a resistance to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But do we still need to be confrontational?
We do. We still need to be very assertive and challenge and demand full civil rights. I think we got on this road of asking for piecemeal rights that really did not serve us at all. I mean, I think in the 70s and 80s, early 80s, we were sort of more demanding in that sense. We were asking for a full civil rights bill, a federal civil rights bill. And then we got on this road of, well, there's been a backlash. Anita Bryant came, and AIDS came, and all these ugly people came, and let's just ask for this little piece of legislation with religious exemptions. And it was the non-confrontational approach. And, you know, let's just sort of, ask for little piecemeal things. And I think ACT UP, certainly, and other groups showed us that, no, you need to be confrontational, but not just with direct action and protest, which I still think is very important, but also in what you demand. You need to demand all of it, otherwise you're not taken seriously.
It seems really difficult to drive something like a LGBT Civil Rights Act, which has been attempted now for decades, for more than 20 years, right? But why can we sort of mobilize a protest but not somehow grab civil rights?
We won a media battle, and that's what keeps happening now, these media battles. But have we won any rights out of that? Mm-hmm. The law in Indiana was mitigated slightly, but it's still broader than the federal RINFRA. And in Indiana, there is no statewide law protecting people. You know, yes, there are in localities in some cities, Indianapolis, but local ordinances are toothless. They don't really do much. You need a statewide law, you need a federal law. So there was no win there. Arkansas, what got lost in the entire thing, under the radar, with none of the gay groups, HRC, Human Rights Campaign, the media, nobody, and grassroots activists were screaming for attention. Under the radar, the Arkansas legislature passed a bill that rescinded all existing local ordinances and the ability to pass any others. So basically, you cannot even pass a law in Little Rock to protect LGBT people, but they worded it in a way to get around the Supreme Court's ruling on this with the Colorado case many years ago. They got around this by not naming LGBT people. So they said, unless you're a group that's already protected in state law, you can't pass a local law. So it becomes this circular thing. None of that got discussed in this. So Arkansas didn't need a RNFRA totally. That was overkill on the part of the governor to completely pander to bigotry. And in the end, we have both states with no civil rights, and we won a battle where Walmart came out and spoke with us, spoke for us, and then mm-hmm. they're giving money to Ted Cruz tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, all of those companies are still giving money to anti-gay politicians.
So what can we do to get those civil rights laws, those positive laws passed? Because it has been 20 years. Why can't how do we do that?
Well, we need to, this gets us back to being confrontational.
Yeah, right.
We need to really be organizing at every different level. And we have so many ways now that we can organize in addition to, you know, protest out on the streets. I mean, we have so many different ways to organize online and pressure entities. I mean, we should have been, and there should be an organized campaign, and our national group should be organizing people to now, you know, target these companies and these politicians to actually pass the laws that we need. Right. I say we need to, you know, organize in Washington more. We need to put ourselves out there. We need to engage in civil disobedience. We need to do all of the things we did in the old-fashioned way, uh-huh. and we also need to do all the new stuff online and really kind of try to galvanize people.
So let's talk about some of those terrible laws that are on the books already. You write in the book about, I believe it's 9 states that have no promo homo laws, as they're called. What are those, and what does that even mean?
Right. Well, this gets to really another sort of long-term strategy and why it's really far from over, because what we really have to do to battle homophobia, transphobia, is change and revolutionize education, change how people are taught from K through 12 about queer people and about homosexuality, about gender identity, about sexual orientation, and also what California has started, and they're the only state, and it really hasn't started yet, the textbooks I think are coming out this year, but talking about the contributions of prominent LGBT individuals in history, we really need to make it so that people don't go in the closet. That has to be the way we battle the closet. And we really need to start teaching about the reality of who we are. But obviously, that's going to be difficult in and of itself, but it's even more difficult because we have a bunch of states where actually they ban even any discussion of homosexuality. Arizona is one of them, Mississippi is another. Tennessee tried to pass it, and everybody knows that was called the Don't Say Gay Bill, and it blew up as a huge controversy, and thankfully that was something that didn't become a reality. But we have to get those other states to repeal theirs, and then we have to move on this really difficult task of passing laws that would actually incorporate it into the teaching in the way that the African American civil rights movement is taught in school.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do to kind of to engage more people?
Well, I think it's true in every movement. It's always a few people doing everything, you know. I mean, it's always a small crowd. And if you think about it, even during the most dark and horrible days of AIDS, it was still just this small group of people who would get in the street and protest, right? But that small group, you know, if it was 1,000 people at a protest, were able to do enormous things. Mm-hmm. So I think it's always going to be, as with every movement, a small activated group. But what people are able to do, and I think we've seen it, you know, with every group. I think we just saw it with Ferguson and other issues for African Americans. Really capitalize on these events to bring in new people. And you know, if people say you're exploiting a suicide, no, we are using this horrible event that portrays the bigotry we live with to activate people. Mm-hmm. That is what we are doing. Each time you do that, I think it brings in more people. And it activates them, and they, you know, everybody has their story who's an activist of what it was, mm-hmm. what event it was that brought them in.
Right.
So we have to use those events.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks to New America NYC for making that piece available. To hear the whole interview with Michelangelo Signorelli, go to newamericanyc.org or our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get our podcasts, download past shows, and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Laura Flynn.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a morning news and public affairs director, as well as an evening news and public affairs director to manage the news and public affairs programming. For these two full-time positions, we're looking for people with proven experience in audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tesla City Stories on Friday, June 28th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tesla City Stories is a live recreation of the Golden Age of Radio performed monthly in downtown Portland. These all-ages shows feature comedy, mysteries, romance, and more, with live Foley sound effects, music, prizes, and audience participation. Again, that's Tesla City Stories on Friday, June 28th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:31 and we're going to bring you Outcasting, wherein veteran gay journalist and activist Andy Hum talks about the historical progression of LGBTQ life and activism since before Stonewall. Another reminder that you can hear all of these programs after they air on kboo.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. So to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And now, here is Outcasting.
The police made a sport out of arresting gay men, especially in, they go to restrooms to entrap gay men, or they just try to entrap a gay man on the street. They hated us, and they were allowed to use the law to act on it and lock you up for it.
This is Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program, where you don't have to be queer to be here. Outcasting is a production of Media for the Public Good, a listener-supported independent producer based in New York, online at outcastingmedia.org. Hi, I'm Andrew, an Outcasting youth participant. This month, June 2019, marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion. In 1969, the Stonewall Inn was a gay bar in New York City's Greenwich Village. In those days, police raids of gay bars were commonplace. Newspapers often printed the names, and sometimes the photos, of people arrested during these raids. Being publicly outed as LGBTQ in this way could lead to the loss of homes, jobs, and families. During one such raid, on a hot night in late June 1969, patrons at the Stonewall Inn rose up and fought against the police. This led to a series of riots over the next several nights. In the wake of the Stonewall Uprising, new activist groups were formed and took hold, and the Stonewall Uprising thus marked a major turning point in LGBTQ activism. Many of the pride marches around the world commemorate the events at Stonewall in June 1969. Here at Outcasting, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising by talking with Andy Hum, a veteran gay journalist and activist based in New York City. On this series, we discuss LGBTQ history and activism since before Stonewall, and how things have changed since then. This is part one of a series. Andy Hum, welcome to Outcasting.
Thank you, Andrew.
We're now celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, often considered the spark of the modern gay rights movement.
That's not necessarily true, since it was more of a marker of a turning point than a cause of the turning point. But either way, Stonewall marked significant changes in the gay rights movement. So we want to use this anniversary to look back on the modern gay rights movement. So we're going to start talking about what life was like for LGBTQ people before the early activism of the Daughters of Bilitis and the Mattachine Society. So first of all, what were some of the laws against LGBTQ people at that point?
Well, they've had laws against sodomy, meaning even consensual gay lovemaking, forever. Even in the United States of America, we had the death penalty for sodomy back in colonial days. Thomas Jefferson tried to change that to castration and was unsuccessful. So the laws were terrible. I mean, even in Great Britain, the last people to be hanged for sodomy was in about 1830-something, I think. So the laws were terrible. But they kept those sodomy laws on the books for a long, 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 long time. So we were sort of a criminal class. And of course, every major religion condemned us. It was not a good scene. But having said all that, gay people always found each other. People always had relationships. Obviously, they had to be done sub rosa. There's a famous thing that lesbians did. They had what they called Boston marriages, where two women would get together and live together. Maybe they were just referred to in the town as spinsters or something, but they were lovers. So we always had gay life, but it took a long, long time for people to be able to live openly.
So at that point, how were gay people able to identify each other?
Well, we all have gaydar, don't we? I think people pick up on the way people look at each other. Sometimes those things are misinterpreted. I mean, I've read things in the 1890s where men would parade around with red ties in order to be seen. And there always seemed to develop places that gay people could go. In New York, there were bars that might not have been completely gay, but people knew that they could go there and meet other men who were like themselves. There were places in parks. In Greenwich Village, which has sort of been a place for gay people for a long, long time, there were various streets where people knew that they could walk. And the police, yes, would harass people, and they'd have to move on, and then they'd find another street, but they've been doing that for years.
So at that point, what were the consequences of being found out that you were gay?
Well, you could be arrested, you could be put in jail, you could serve a long prison sentence. I mean, I'm 65 years old, but I know guys in their 80s, and it's hard to find any of them who didn't have one bad experience with the law, where they were arrested, and oftentimes it was a shakedown. They just want to get some money out of you, or you'd have to pay a lot of money for this lawyer who would get you out of trouble. It was very, very rough. And of course, you know, if you tried to live an open life, you were limiting your chances of employment severely. So very few people in very few professions were able to be anything like out. I mean, look what happened to Oscar Wilde, after all. He was put in jail for 2 years in the 1890s and died shortly thereafter.
So, starting with pre-Stonewall activism in the 1950s, tell us about the Daughters of Bilitis and the Mattachine Society and their significance.
Actually, there's an earlier gay group in Illinois called the Society for Individual Rights, I think, SIR, in like the 1920s in Illinois, you know, which was sort of people getting together. And even the people who formed the Mattachine Society in 1950, they had an earlier group called Bachelors for Wallace, because Henry Wallace was a leftist and he had been vice president of the United States, and they wanted him to be president of the United States in 1948. So they formed that group, because a lot of the people who formed the early groups were leftists. It didn't stay that way for long, but people like Harry Hay, who was one of the main founders of the Mattachine Society, was. And they are people who got together, starting in California, and then they formed chapters around the country, to try to advocate for themselves in some way. And sometimes that meant standing up for somebody who'd been arrested on a morals charge and trying to break that. The Daughters of Bilitis, it was a lesbian group that, again, started more of a social group. And then back in 1955, which was 2 years after I was born, and one of the founders I know is still alive, Phyllis Lyon, with Del Martin. Again, these groups started sort of, it was a way just for people to be with each other, which itself was kind of very dangerous, but they did it. And that sort of started the ball rolling in the movement.
So in the 50s, were gay activists focused more on assimilation into mainstream society or rebellion from it?
Well, I mean, obviously, most gay people tried to assimilate, tried to live underground, essentially. Most gay people, in order to survive, had to enter heterosexual marriages. Sometimes a lesbian and a gay man would get married for cover, but most didn't. And of course, this was very bad for the whole family. And sometimes you'd have sex on the side or a partner on the side, whatever. It was a terrible situation. And of course, World War II happened. That brought a lot of gay people from around the country to the big cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York, right? As their ports of departure for the war. And when they got to these cities, they did see there were a lot of people living a gay life, and they never went back to Iowa. They stayed here, and there was a certain level of tolerance, but the laws were bad. I mean, I live in New York. The laws were bad for a long time. We didn't even get rid of the sodomy laws in New York until 1980 through a court order.
So tell us about Frank Kameny and government policies towards gay people.
Frank Kameny had a personal experience of discrimination in the 1950s, and he was working for the government as an astronomer, which was his profession. And when they found out that he was gay, they fired him. And he didn't take it. He decided to bring a lawsuit against the government to try to get reinstated. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. It was refused by them, but he explored every opportunity. Many, many years later, President Obama had him into the White House when he signed an order covering federal employees from discrimination, although that had been done somewhat by previous presidents. Even Jimmy Carter had gays in the White House. So Frank was sort of the original activist in many ways, public activist, and he was a very fierce speaker, and he was relentless. I mean, he once appeared before a committee in Congress early on, this is in the 60s, and they said, does your organization as we're reading hundreds of thousands of members? And he said, we hope to, Senator, we hope to. He was very unapologetic. And he coined the term, gay is good. Because some of the early people, even some of the gay groups, there were gay groups in New York, including Mattachine to some extent, a little bit, they would have speakers in to tell us how sick we were. Because under the American Psychiatric Association, we were classified as mentally ill people up until 1973. And by the way, that was a huge breakthrough when activists worked with sympathetic psychiatrists to get us removed from the index of mental disorders. It's amazing that they were able to do that in 1973 because the movement was so young in those days.
So by the 60s, were gay activists more willing to reject mainstream society or consider themselves more radical?
I wouldn't call it radical until after Stonewall, really. You had people like Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings and Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. You had those people, but there were very few people who took a radical attitude towards activism until Stonewall. And that's why Stonewall is so significant. There had been some previous rebellions that we've read about, right? There was Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco, where a lot of transgender and drag queens and gay men hung out at night in San Francisco, and they were harassed by the police, and they fought back and threw coffee at them and demonstrated. And that led to a little bit of organizing. But the reason Stonewall is so significant in 1969, so you had this rebellion, and it went on for 6 nights of people throwing things and marching around the village. But in the midst of that, the Gay Liberation Front was founded and organized right then and there. People went off to a room and they did it. And then within short order, you had groups proliferating all over the country. Now, again, these weren't the first demonstrations. I mean, Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings and others did those things called the annual reminder picket at Independence Hall, I believe starting in 1965. And even before that, there's an activist named Randy Wicker who picketed the selective service system, the draft board, because they were classifying us as mentally ill. And that was the first public demonstration in the United States. It was in 1964, right in downtown New York. But again, that didn't lead to a lot of ongoing organizing. Things just exploded after Stonewall.
Why do you think it was that you know, before Stonewall, gay activists were sort of shying away from, you know, ideas of radicalism or kind of more outright rebellion.
I would say, A, because they wanted to live, and B, because they wanted to keep their jobs. I mean, it was a matter of survival. You know, I used to work with gay youth when I was at the Hetrick Martin Institute, and when it came to advising people about coming out in those days, and I'm talking about the mid-80s, you'd have to say, you can't be sure how your parents are going to react unless you're absolutely sure that it's going to be fine, and it's very hard to do that. You better have another place to stay because parents often throw their kids out when they're gay. Obviously, that happens a lot less. People are coming out in younger and younger ages now, and that's terrific, but it's still hard for a lot of people in a lot of parts of the country and certainly in a lot of parts of the world. I mean, the idea of openly gay people in some societies, if you want to talk about Uganda or Russia or these places, it's very, 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 very tough.
So what was life like for LGBTQ people living in San Francisco or New York or other major cities in the 60s?
Before Stonewall, there was gay culture. People had partners. I have friends who were together in those days and are together to this day. They're very old. But people met each other and encountered each other and, you know, got together. It's not a new thing. But they lived pretty discreet lives. You had to be fairly discreet. It was very hard to come out on the job. And I understand there were very few images of gay people in the media. I mean, there were some gay images of gay people in the movies, right, since they invented the form. And they used to have sissy characters in some of the movies in the 1930s and 40s and beyond. But they were not generally positive images. They were just all we had. So it was a matter of leading a rather discreet life. You had to, I mean, and I wouldn't say those people were self-hating. What choice did they have? For instance, take here's an example. E.M. Forster is a famous novelist, right? He wrote Howard's End and Passage to India, English novelist, right? He wrote a gay book starting in 1913, I think, called Morris, based on his own gay experiences. He didn't allow it to be published until after his death in 1970. Became a movie, but I mean, that's what you had to do. You had to sort of cover things up. There were some writers, like Gore Vidal, who wrote gay-themed books in the 60s, and he didn't even publicly identify as a gay man, although he obviously was, but because of the content of the book that he wrote, the New York Times was so horrified, they wouldn't review his books for about 15 years, and he's a very famous novelist.
So what sorts of discrimination did LGBTQ people face from the law and the police at that point?
Well, the police made a sport out of arresting gay men, especially in, like, they'd go to restrooms to entrap gay men, or they just try to entrap a gay man on the street. They hated us, and they were allowed to use the law to act on it and lock you up for it. And that's something that continues to this day in many parts of the country. It's absolutely outrageous. I mean, you don't even have to be doing anything. They just figure, you look gay, I'll arrest you, and the court will believe me. Now, that's why we had to get rid of the sodomy laws. But again, they still go after people for solicitation. And to this day, they still go after transgender people just for walking down the street. They say, oh, you're prostituting yourself, even though you're just transgender and you're just walking down the street.
This is Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program, produced by Media for the Public Good in New York, online at outcastingmedia.org. June 2019 is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, a series of riots that marked a major turning point in LGBTQ activism. Our guest on this Outcasting series is veteran gay journalist and activist Andy Hum. We're talking about how LGBTQ life and activism have evolved over the decades. So tell us about the rebellion at Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco in 1966.
Compton's was a place you could go late at night to get a meal, partly because if you were trans or drag queen, you often had trouble getting into the gay bars, such as they were. And so this is where they could hang out. Compton's didn't particularly like it. This was in the Tenderloin District, and they would often call the police to get them out of there. But in 1966, trans people, drag queens, gay men were there, and you know, the police, people who owned Compton's once again wanted there to be a sweep of Compton's, and the police got rough. So the patrons fought back, threw coffee at the police. There was a melee. And the police are always shocked when gay people or trans people or drag queens or anybody fights back. This was at a time, by the way, when cross-dressing was illegal. You had to wear clothing appropriate to your gender or you could be arrested just for that. So that's how the police used to go after it. But I've read about the Comptons thing, and there was some organizing that sort of grew out of it, where people protested a bit and tried to form an organization to stand up for themselves. But the point is, you know, and the reason, again, Stonewall is so important is because it's not something that was very sustained.
So 3 years later, in 1969, the Stonewall Rebellions happened in New York City, perhaps the most famous moment in LGBTQ history. So what happened in the build-up to Stonewall?
Well, building up to the Stonewall, you have to understand the context of 1969. You've already had the civil rights movement, right? Martin Luther King, all that. Martin Luther King was, you know, murdered in 1968. Politics was very fractious in the United States. If you think it's fractious now, I mean, there were a lot of riots in the streets in those days. African Americans had risen up in their communities, and there were riots all over the place. People died in those riots. So there was something in the air, and a lot of gay people were involved in the civil rights movement, whether they were African American or Caucasian. They were involved in the civil rights movement, and many people were involved in the anti-war movement in 1969. So there was that revolution in the air kind of thing going on. So these were the kind of people, when you oppressed them, when you went after them, they were more willing to protest. Now, who was at the Stonewall? The Stonewall was mostly street kids for the most part, and it was not a very nice place from everything I've read. According to Tommy Lanigan Schmidt, who was about 18 at the time, and was there, it was a place where they allowed you to dance and touch each other. Because in gay bars, even in New York, you weren't allowed to touch each other without being thrown out of the bar. I'm talking about just like touching on the shoulder or giving a hug or something like that. So this was a great thing. So police routinely raided gay bars in those days, usually because they didn't get their payoff from the mafia who ran the bars. And in this case, this was just people got their noses out of joint. As they started to take people out of the bar to load them into the police wagon, people started to fight back. And then people started fighting back within the bar, outside the bar, throwing things. The police ended up having to barricade themselves inside the bar for protection. They thought they were going to die. And this raid was overseen by Inspector Pine, his name was. I don't think it's nice that they were raiding gay bars, but I will give him credit for one thing. He told the police inside that bar, don't use your guns, don't fire at anybody until I say so. Because they were throwing garbage cans at the window, they threw a Molotov cocktail at the place. Everybody was pretty scared. And I think the LGBT people who were part of this rebellion were sort of surprised at themselves that they were standing up to the police. Eventually they burned a police car. And this, again, this thing went on for 6 nights. And it's part of it is due to the fact of the way, if you've ever been down to Greenwich Village where the Stonewall was or is, or there's still a bar there called Stonewall. It's not the original one. But the streets are labyrinthine. They go all over the place, and you can go around corners very quickly and easily, and it's not like a grid like the rest of the city. So they played cat and mouse for 6 nights. It was terrific. By the way, Dick Leitch, if you know that name, he just died last year. He was the head of the Mattachine Society at the time, and he wrote an in-person report that night about what happened. And one of the things he said, you know, before Stonewall, nobody was gay. After Stonewall, everybody was gay. The whole idea of coming out, people felt empowered, was just contagious among people. But the main group that came out of Stonewall was the Gay Liberation Front, a radical group, which only lasted for about 2 years, but it was important.
So what was the immediate effect of Stonewall on the LGBTQ rights movement?
Well, I mentioned that the Gay Liberation Front was organized, but then other groups started sprouting off that or from that, and it just gave people a sense that we can do something about the situation that we're in, and we're going to fight back. So there were all kinds of demonstrations and zaps. There were so many injustices to fight in those days because we had no rights whatsoever. And so when people were discriminated against, maybe there'd be a picket line there. The Gay Activists Alliance was formed shortly thereafter, simply focusing on gay rights. And then the Lesbian Feminist Liberation was formed. And then by 1973, you started to have some institutionalization. You know, groups like Lambda Legal Defense were formed. It just blossomed. The movement blossomed. You know, again, I joined the Dignity Group for gay Catholics. That was like formed, I think, around 1969. And I think that the Metropolitan Community Church is even older than that. Religious groups started to come up and things just got rolling very, very fast.
So you mentioned earlier that it wasn't really until after Stonewall that gay activists were willing to consider themselves radical or sort of rise up against mainstream society. Why do you think it was that Stonewall had that effect?
Well, I think it was kind of radical just to live a gay life prior to Stonewall. I mean, just to give yourself a gay life, to have a partner, to go to a gay establishment, to live the life, that was kind of a radical thing in itself. And as I said, there were a few people who ventured out into the streets and had some picketing demonstrations, very respectful, either at the White House or at Independence Hall in Philadelphia or elsewhere around the country. They used to have this annual thing in Philadelphia. It was called the Annual Reminder from the mid-60s to right up to Stonewall. And the year of Stonewall, because this was always held on July the 4th, the year of Stonewall, that's so July the 4th is right after Stonewall, because Stonewall happened in June. Then a lot of the more radical people came down to Philadelphia, and they weren't willing to put on suits and ties and dresses. And when I say dresses, I mean the lesbians were told they had to wear dresses at the annual reminder that Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings used to organize. And jeans wearing radicals, and everybody came out. And so that was the last time they did that. But there were demonstrations all the time after that.
So in 1970, the East Coast Homophile Organization organized the Christopher Street Liberation Day March to commemorate the first anniversary of Stonewall. What was the purpose of this march?
Well, that was a coalition, and especially Craig Rodwell from New York, who ran the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop, which was around even before Stonewall, said we need to do something on the anniversary of our rebellion. And there was some resistance to this, but enough people organized that said they were going to do it. They had no idea what was going to happen. So they started putting up posters around town saying we're going to have a march and it's going to be on the Sunday, which is closest to the anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion. And they just didn't even know if anybody was going to show up. And they were kind of scared because they were going to be marching en masse from Greenwich Village all the way up to Central Park for a rally. And maybe in the beginning, hundreds of people showed up in the village, and the police only gave them half of 6th Avenue. So there was traffic running by on the avenue next to them. And they said they were so scared because they'd gotten a lot of death threats when they said they were going to do this. They almost ran all the way up to Central Park. And by the time they got to the park, there were thousands of people in the park. The march stretched 15 blocks, and they had this sort of gay in the park. You can Google it and look at the beautiful footage of this thing. And can you imagine, in a society where you'd never seen so many gay people together, here they all were. And boy, that gives you a real sense of empowerment. I didn't join really the movement much until 1975 or 74. But when we had our first march on Washington in 1979, I had the same experience. We didn't know how many people were going to come down to Washington from all over the country. And when I saw all these thousands of people, I cried. You know, even though I'd been an activist for many years already, it just was so moving and empowering.
So tell us about some of the other marches that this inspired.
First of all, you know, people started organizing pride marches, and they did come up with that word pride. It's interesting. Apparently, they had a debate in 1970. What are we going to call this? And some people wanted to call it gay power, and then some people said, we don't have any power. I mean, gay power was a chant of the day, but they said, we want to show that we have pride in who we are. So the word pride came into it. But it was called the Christopher Street Gay Liberation March that year. And then for many years, it was just called the Christopher Street Liberation Day March before it changed into, now they in New York, they call it something like Heritage of Pride. In San Francisco, they call it the Freedom Day Parade. And of course, now it's done all over the world. I mean, we constantly hear from tiny little towns all over the country, because I do the Gay USA show and we report on these things. Tiny little towns having pride marches. And then, of course, the people who really take the biggest risk are these people in Uganda, in Moscow, who will get shut down by the police if they try to do it. In some of these Eastern European countries, there has to be tremendous protection by the police or even the army for some people to march down the street. And in many cases, they just try to shut it down. But it is something that has proliferated around the world.
That's all the time we have for now, but we'll continue this conversation on the next edition of Outcasting. Andy Hum, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Andrew.
Andy joined us from his home in New York City. This has been part one of a series. That's it for this edition of Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program, where you don't have to be queer to be here. This program has been produced by the Outcasting team, including youth participants Alex, Amelie, Dante, Lucas, Drew, and me, Andrew. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Outcasting is a production of Media for the Public Good. More information about Outcasting is available at outcastingmedia.org. You'll find information about the show, listen links for all Outcasting episodes, and the podcast link. Outcasting is also on social media. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Outcasting Media. If you're having trouble, whether it's at home or school or just with yourself, call the Trevor Project hotline at 866-488-7386. Or visit them online at thetrevorproject.org. The Trevor Project is an organization dedicated to LGBTQ youth suicide prevention. Call them if you have a problem. Seriously, don't be scared. They even have an online chat you can use if you don't want to talk on the phone. Being different isn't a reason to hate or hurt yourself. I'll say it one more time. 866-488-7386 or online at thetrevorproject.org. You can also find a link on our site, outcastingmedia.org, under Outcasting.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose. Bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this.